Chapter 2. Hey, Sky, take off your hat. I'm on my way. As the death toll in Europe rose with alarming speed in early 1917, and merchant ships lost to enemy U-boats increased to unfathomable numbers, President Woodrow Wilson stood before Congress and asked for a declaration of war to end all wars. With that, the United States entered World War I. As thousands of men shipped out and headed off to the trenches of Europe, women were called to serve. From cities and towns across the country, more than 20,000 women were activated and sent to the nation's heartland to keep food production moving forward while the men who had once worked America's farms were away. Known as the Women's Land Army of America, WLAA, many of its volunteers had never seen a plow or tractor, let alone operated one. The women were known as farmerettes and were paid the same wages as their male counterparts. Although the war ended in 1918 with the men returning home to their farms, many within the WLAA wanted to continue the work they had started, but financial restrictions forced the program to shut down in 1920. The women returned to their homes and were once again relegated to being housewives and homemakers. Women were called upon in a similar manner during World War II, when 350,000 of them volunteered for uniform duty in the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps, WACS, as well as the Navy, Marine, and Coast Guard Women's Reserve, and the Army and Navy Nurse Corps. Another 4.5 million became known as Rosie the Riveters when they joined the defense industry, working in factories building aircraft. Prior to entering the war, the United States produced only 921 planes annually. With the help of the Rosies, that number swelled to more than 92,000 units annually by 1944, with a total of more than 300,000 planes being built by war's end. In an interview with the Library of Congress, Boeing line worker Inez Sauer said that her mother cautioned her about factory work. "My mother warned me when I took the job that I would never be the same," she said. "You will never want to go back to being a housewife. After the war, I couldn't go back." That was the attitude of many of the women who served their country during the war. There was no going back to their previous life and status. Women had proven to the world that they were up for a challenge and could do the job of their male counterparts. But as was the case following the previous war, most of the women returned to being housewives. When they did continue in the workforce, they found themselves playing second fiddle to their male counterparts, earning meager wages at best, and often relegated to minor positions. The same attitudes toward women persisted as America ramped up its quest to send a human into space. Sending a woman into the cosmos was considered almost blasphemous to many of the men involved in the program. But there were those who looked beyond the stereotypes and genuinely believed that women could do the same job as men in space, if not better. One of those men was Dr. Randolph Lovelace. Influenced by his uncle, who had established a medical research facility in Albuquerque, New Mexico, Lovelace enrolled in college at Washington University in St. Louis at the age of 19, during which time he developed a passion for flying. He joined the U.S. Naval Reserve Training Corps, eventually earning his wings at the Great Lakes Naval Station in Illinois. Lovelace continued his education, earning degrees from Harvard and a surgical fellowship at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. That fellowship helped him become a flight surgeon at the U.S. Army School of Aviation Medicine, USASM, in 1937. During his stint at USASM, Lovelace helped develop a new oxygen delivery mask for pilots flying at high altitudes. To demonstrate the mask's reliability, Lovelace strapped two oxygen bottles to his legs, donned the mask, and planned to jump out of a bomber at an altitude of 40,200 feet. The air temperature at that altitude was a frigid minus 47 degrees Fahrenheit. His jump would be a static line leap, in which his parachute, connected to the plane, would automatically deploy once the line reached its maximum length. The plane took off, and after reaching the desired altitude, Lovelace stepped out of it. Within seconds, the static cord grew taut. The static line jerked Lovelace as it deployed the chute, ripping off one of the doctor's gloves and knocking him unconscious. 23 minutes later, with barely enough time to brace for landing, Lovelace awoke and made a successful landing. He was unscathed, save for some frostbite on his ungloved hand. Although he could have been reprimanded for this foolhardy test, he was instead awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross for his successful demonstration of the mask, and for making a record-breaking skydive simultaneously. It was Dr. Lovelace's first and last parachute jump. In 1947, Lovelace joined his uncle in New Mexico and established the Lovelace Foundation for Medicine, Education, and Research. Soon after, the man who would become NASA's first administrator, T. Keith Glennon, appointed Lovelace and Brigadier General Donald Flickinger to head the Special Committee on Life Sciences, where they were charged with developing and administering medical and psychological tests for America's first astronauts. In all, 24 applicants were subjected to the grueling tests. They were poked and prodded in unmentionable places, survived cardiopulmonary stress testing, as well as heat stress tests in compact ovens. The list of evaluation tests seemed endless. Of the 24 applicants tested, only 7 made the final cut. And on April 9, 1959, America's Mercury 7 astronauts were introduced to the world. But while the 7 were being pummeled with questions from the overeager journalists in attendance who were nearly climbing over one another to ask sometimes insightful and sometimes silly questions, Dr. Lovelace sat quietly on the stage, aware that there were other candidates waiting in the wings who were equally qualified to endure the rigors of spaceflight. While Dr. Lovelace and General Flickinger were administering the tests to the Mercury 7, they pondered whether women would make good astronauts. Lovelace approached a good friend of his, famed pilot Jackie Cochran, to help with a new project, which was informally called the Women in Space Program. Cochran was a steadfast supporter of women in aviation, having herself set several speed and altitude records, won countless aviation races, and became the first woman to break the speed of sound in 1953, and then to reach Mach 2 in 1962. In 1 year alone, she broke 73 records. What Cochran was most noted for, however, was the formation of the Women's Air Force Service Pilots, WASP, program during World War II, which sought women to help in the war effort by testing aircraft and shuttling them across the Atlantic to the front. Being such a champion for women in aviation, Cochran and her husband, Robert, were more than happy to fund the fledgling female astronaut testing program when Lovelace approached her about it in 1960. Even before the funding was secured, Flickinger and Lovelace already had in mind who they wanted to be the first woman to join the program, Geraldine Jerry Cobb. Jerry was born in Norman, Oklahoma in 1931. The young girl had a speech impediment that caused her excruciating embarrassment in elementary school due to classmates who often mocked her. She often told what friends she had that, "School is no good. Sometimes it's best to be alone." And that's what she did. Keeping mainly to herself, she found that spending time with horses was much more enjoyable than spending time with people. Cobb's father, Harvey, was in the National Guard when World War II broke out. He was fascinated with flying and requested a transfer to the Army Air Corps, but the request was denied due to his age. Even though the military said he was too old to fly, the Air Corps gave him a glimmer of hope when it told him that he could transfer only if he had a commercial pilot's license. Harvey Cobb did not possess the prestigious license, but was keen on making sure he got one. In 1940, Harvey Cobb came home with a spring in his step, as he proudly announced to his wife and daughters, Jerry and Carolyn, that he had finally earned his license. To celebrate his achievement, Cobb treated himself to a special gift. He purchased a small Taylorcraft airplane. The two girls were ecstatic and couldn't wait to take their first flight. The day following the announcement, the two Cobb girls skipped school, and their father took them on their first airplane flight. Jerry Cobb later recalled the moment. "Even before the old Taylorcraft reached 300 feet," she said, "I recognized the sky would be my home. For a child that distrusted ordinary everyday speech, for an adolescent who yearned for the freedom of the fields and winds, for a girl who had learned to be alone, the sky was the answer." And indeed it was. At age 16, Cobb earned her pilot's license. By 18, she had her commercial license and became a certified ground instructor with ratings in civil air regulations, meteorology, and engine mechanics. She went on to ferry B-17 bombers around the globe and, for good measure, broke several speed, distance, and altitude records. The tests that Lovelace and Flickinger developed for the first phase of their program were intense, to say the least, but Cobb was ready for them. 4-hour eye exams, a full day of x-raying every bone and tooth in her body, pedaling for hours on a specially weighted stationary bike to test respiration that drove her to exhaustion. She spent considerable time inverted on a tilt table to test her blood circulation, had electric pulses shot through her joints to test her reflexes, and swallowed rubber tubes to test stomach acid. Then there was the most excruciating test of all, the ice water test, in which cold, 10-degree water was shot into her ear by a syringe. The frigid water immediately froze the inner ear, causing severe vertigo. In an interview with Carol Butler for the NASA Johnson Space Center Oral History Program, a member of the next group of women to take that same test, Mary Wallace Wally Funk, said that as soon as the water hit her ear, the room began to spin uncontrollably. "You were supposed to focus on a single spot. I couldn't lift my arms and would have fallen off the table to the floor if I weren't strapped in." When all was said and done, Cobb had aced Phase 1 testing. On August 19, 1960, Dr. Lovelace appeared at the Space and Naval Medicine Congress in Stockholm, Sweden, where he announced the results, stating, "We are already in a position to say that certain qualities of the female space pilot are preferable to those of her male counterpart." He then went on to open the floodgates for women to join his program by adding, "There is no question but that women will eventually participate in spaceflight. Therefore, we must obtain data on them comparable to what we have obtained on men." To be selected for the Women in Space program, applicants were required to be pilots with at least 1,000 hours of flight time, have a commercial rating, and possess a college degree, though the latter was not a firm requirement. Out of all the applications received, 25 women were invited to take the second phase of testing. Jackie Cochran was brought in as an advisor, and she and her husband paid for all of the women's expenses. 19 of the invited applicants would test at Lovelace's New Mexico test facility. The women would not test at the same time. Instead, the tests would be administered either individually or the women would be scheduled in pairs. It wasn't until years later that the final group of women who were selected would meet the other candidates. The oldest applicant was 41-year-old Jane Hart, a mother of 8, whose husband was Michigan Senator Philip A. Hart. The youngest was 23-year-old flight instructor Wally Funk. In addition to the tests mentioned earlier, for the second phase of testing, each of the women was strapped into a centrifuge at Oklahoma State University to test her body's reaction to the force of gravity exerted during a launch. Wally Funk recalls that civilians were not allowed to wear pressure suits, and because of that, the women were only allowed to spin at 3 Gs. From her pilot training, she knew that when excessive gravity is placed on the human body, a person's blood flow is forced downward, away from the brain, which could cause the pilot to black out. To avoid this, the blood had to be forced upward, and without a pressurized flight suit, blacking out was highly likely, thanks to the dizzying tests the women would endure. Funk wrote to her mother and asked if she would send her a merry widow. When it was her turn in the centrifuge, Funk wore the tight-fitting girdle beneath her clothing to help equalize the pressure, and she made it through with flying colors. Three of the subjects, Funk, Jerry Cobb, and Rhea Hurley, were also tested in an isolation tank. Men went through a similar isolation test, but the male version of the test was set up in a small, dimly lit or completely dark room where they sat in a chair, having plenty of time to contemplate what was going on. The women, on the other hand, were made to float on their backs in a water tank. The humidity in the room and the water temperature was balanced to match the women's body temperature exactly, which caused them to lose all sensory perception, sight, hearing, smell, and feel. The women recall it being a blissful and tranquil experience. Funk, in fact, set a record by remaining in the tank for 10 hours and 35 minutes and had to be asked to terminate the test. The women also took part in ejection seat testing, wherein they were strapped to a seat attached to a vertical rail that shot straight up in the air like a rocket. The effect pushed 12 Gs of force on their bodies before they came back down with a thud. Lastly, the women participated in high-altitude evaluations by traveling in a plane to an altitude of more than 39,000 feet while breathing pure oxygen. Once they reached altitude, they removed the oxygen mask and were asked to write letters and numbers on a notepad. The human body can last only 4 to 6 minutes without oxygen before passing out. In Wally Funk's case, she quickly began to black out when she removed the mask. The technicians overseeing the test saw the condition she was in and ordered her to put the mask back on, but she didn't respond. They rushed into the test area of the plane where Funk was seated and placed the oxygen mask back on her face, and just that fast, she was revived. Funk said that during the test without the mask on, she believed that she was acing it and writing perfectly, but when she looked at the paper afterward, all she saw were lines of incomprehensible gibberish. As the summer of 1961 slid into fall, 13 of the 19 women, Cobb, Funk, Hurley, and Hart, as well as Myrtle Cagle, Janet Dietrich, her twin sister Marion Dietrich, Sarah Gorlick, Jean Hickson, Jean Nora Stumbaugh, Irene Leverton, Jerry Sloan, and Bernice Stedman, had passed the Phase 2 tests. Informally, the 13 women called themselves the First Lady Astronaut Trainees, or FLATs. When the media got word of their achievements, they became known as the Mercury 13. The Mercury 13 had performed admirably, and they achieved test scores much higher than their male counterparts. Lovelace and Flickinger invited the women to participate in the third and final series of tests at the Naval School of Aviation Medicine in Pensacola, Florida. A few of the women quit their jobs so that they could attend training, but only a few days before their arrival in Florida, the 13 women were informed via telegram from NASA that because the Lovelace evaluations were privately funded and were not authorized by NASA, the training had been canceled. It's true that being a civilian project most likely caused the cancellation of the program, but beneath it all was the nagging stereotype that women were not suited to go into space. Shortly after the hopes of the Mercury 13 were dashed, Linda Halpern, a young schoolgirl who was enthralled by the space program, wrote to President Kennedy to ask how she could become an astronaut. The letter was forwarded to NASA's Office of Public Affairs. The response was cordial, but to the point. While many women are employed in other capacities in the space program, we have no present plans to employ women on space flights because of the degree of scientific and flight training and the physical characteristics which are required. Another woman whose name has become a footnote to this story and pushed to the back pages of history is Betty Skelton. Born in Pensacola, Skelton would become an outstanding pilot in her own right, having made her first solo flight at the age of 12 when Navy Ensign Kenneth Wright, who was teaching her to fly, let her take control of a Taylorcraft aircraft. Her first legal solo was at the age of 16. Skelton went on to break many speed records, and according to the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum, she holds more combined aircraft and automotive records than anyone in history. She began her career as an aerobatic flyer in 1946, taking to the air for her first air show at the 1946 Southeastern Air Exposition, sharing the skies with a brand new flying team that was also just starting out, the Blue Angels. Skelton and the Blues became close friends, and she was known as the Sweetheart of the Blues. The aviator earned the respect of one of the future Mercury 7 astronauts, Wally Schirra, when Schirra and his squadron at the Pensacola Naval Air Station sat in a hangar in 1948, watching a torrential Gulf Coast downpour. Through the rain, they heard the engine of a tiny biplane and watched as the pilot skillfully landed in the storm. The men watched as the pilot stepped from the plane. Who was he? The pilot removed his helmet, and long brown hair poured out. The pilot wasn't a man, but a woman, Betty Skelton. In 1960, Look magazine prepared to run the cover story, Should a Girl Be First in Space?, and asked Skelton to take the same tests that the Mercury 13 women had. Once again, a woman passed the tests with flying colors, for which Schirra called her Mercury 7.5, but Skelton was realistic about the results, saying that the test was just a media stunt. Jerry Cobb and Jane Hart, on the other hand, were not going to stand idly by and let their chances to become astronauts slip away. In a letter to President Kennedy and Vice President Lyndon B. Johnson, the women spelled out the reasons why the Loveless program needed to continue and asked that it be restarted. Johnson did query NASA Administrator James Webb about whether women had been turned down for a seat in a capsule simply because they were women, but at the bottom of his letter to Webb, he scribbled the words, "Let's stop this now." Hart petitioned and was granted a hearing on sex discrimination with the U.S. House of Representatives Special Subcommittee on the Selection of Astronauts. The hearing convened on July 17, 1962, with Hart and Cobb testifying on behalf of the Mercury 13. The two women laid out a powerful case for including women in the astronaut corps. Hart argued that, "For many women, the PTA is just not enough. I don't want to downgrade the feminine role of a wife, mother, and homemaker, but I don't think it unwomanly to be intelligent, to be courageous, to be energetic, to be anxious to contribute to human knowledge." For the most part, the hearings were cordial, and many of the congressmen were sympathetic to the women's aspirations, but the inevitable stereotypes were still present, as is evident from the hearing transcripts. Mr. Victor Anfuso, congressman from New York, following opening statements by Jane Hart. "Miss Cobb, I think that we can safely say at this time that the whole purpose of space exploration is to someday colonize these other planets, and I don't see how we can do that without women." Laughter. "I call on Mrs. Hart." Mrs. Hart. "I would like to say, I couldn't help but notice that you call upon me immediately after you referred to colonizing space." Mr. Anfuso. "That's why I did it." Laughter. Also testifying were two of the Mercury 7 astronauts, Scott Carpenter and John Glenn, who spelled out the requirements for being a NASA astronaut, which included having engineering degrees and being a military jet test pilot, two qualifications that would not be afforded to women for decades. Glenn put the exclamation point on the proceedings when he testified, "Men go off and fight the wars and fly the airplanes and come back and help design and build and test them. The fact that women are not in this field is a fact of our social order." The fate of the Mercury 13 was sealed, and the program officially ended. During the hearing, Jerry Cobb was asked by Representative Anfuso if she believed that the Soviet Union was planning to launch a woman into space. "Yes," she replied. "It is a known fact that they have women pilots in their armed forces." "Do you feel it is essential to have been a test pilot before you qualify as an astronaut?" another congressman asked. "I personally feel it is not essential at all," she replied. Cobb was correct. The Soviet Union was planning to send a woman into space, and the fact that she was not a pilot was not a disqualifying factor. In late 1962, a delegation of Soviet engineers and cosmonauts, including Yuri Gagarin, visited the United States as part of a worldwide promotional tour. During the visit, they dined with President Kennedy and met with their American counterparts. After the fanfare of their visit had faded to memory and the delegation headed home, they took with them more than just memories and souvenirs. They left with the impression that the Americans were preparing to launch a woman into space. Of course, the Soviets could not be upstaged, and a plan was quickly put in place to beat the Americans to the draw. The push was initiated by the head of the cosmonaut training program, General Nikolai Kamanin, who had trained the country's first three cosmonauts, Gagarin, German Titov, and Alexei Leonov. Kamanin recruited some serious support for the effort, including the backing of the man who pioneered manned spaceflight in the Soviet Union, Sergei Korolev. The requirements to win a seat aboard a Vostok capsule were simple. Women must be younger than 30 years old, weigh less than 155 pounds, and be shorter than 5.5 feet tall. Unlike American astronauts, a college degree and flight experience were optional. There was one additional requirement that was non-negotiable. Each applicant must have skydiving experience. The reason for this was that the Vostok spacecraft wasn't designed to land with a cosmonaut inside of it. Instead, they would eject from the spacecraft high above the ground and parachute to a safe landing separate from the capsule. As soon as the requirements were laid out and the ink had dried, invitations were sent out to female members of local skydiving clubs across the country. Most of the invitations were clandestine in nature. For example, Muscovite Valentina Ponomaryova was a 28-year-old staffer at the Department of Applied Mathematics at Steklov Mathematical Institute. At a New Year's Eve office party, a colleague asked her to dance. As they swayed to the music, he whispered in her ear, "Would you like to fly higher than any pilot?" Ponomaryova thought that the comment was obviously a joke and laughed it off. But after being approached several more times by her colleague, she decided to take a chance and submitted an application to be a cosmonaut. The application made it to the president of the USSR Academy of Science, Mstislav Keldysh, who invited her to his office for an interview. His first question to her was, "Why do you like to fly?" She thought about it for a moment and replied, "I don't know." Keldysh looked at the young woman and replied, "That's right. We can never know why we like to fly." Despite an objection by Gagarin, who said, "We cannot put the life of a mother at risk by sending her to space," Ponomaryova had one child, her application was accepted. In all, 800 women applied to the Soviet space program. 58 of those were formally considered, and only 23 made the final cut to take part in advanced training and medical evaluations. One of the fortunate few was 26-year-old Valentina Tereshkova. Tereshkova was born into a working-class family on March 6, 1937, 170 miles northeast of Moscow, in the town of Maslennikovo. As a young teen, she worked at a textile factory, where she quickly rose through the ranks of the Communist Party and was elected secretary of the youth organization on the Komsomol Committee. During these formative years, her love of skydiving began. She joined a local parachuting club and took her first jump in 1959 at the age of 22. Her loyalty to the Communist Party and the 126 jumps she had made by 1961 made her a prime candidate for the program. Eventually, the final 23 candidates were cut to five. They became known as the Space Squad. Zhanna Yorkina, Irina Slovyova, Tatiana Kuznetsova, Valentina Ponomaryova, and Valentina Tereshkova. The women were sent to Star City, a former Soviet Air Force base hidden away in the forest just northeast of Moscow, which had been converted into the official cosmonaut training center, where the Space Squad was first introduced to the male cosmonauts who were also in training. "The guys," Ponomaryova said, "treated us well, but they were not happy when we five girls first showed up in Star City." Medical evaluations began in late 1962 and were the same as those administered to the men, a long series of X-rays and brain studies, advanced cardiovascular and blood screenings, and the dreaded centrifuge. The women were always confined to the base and never allowed to leave, that is, except for three who were allowed to venture out from time to time because they lived in Moscow, leaving Yorkina and Tereshkova behind. One day, the pair became bored and asked their supervisor if they could spend the day in the city. The man asked, "What for? What do you want to buy?" Tereshkova lost her cool and shouted, "Knickers! That's what we want to buy." The two were allowed to leave. Meanwhile, the Soviet Union scored another first by putting two manned spacecraft in orbit at the same time. Upon returning to Earth, the Kremlin made the decision to replicate the mission, but this time, a serious debate ensued about who should pilot the twin Vostok spacecraft. Should they fly the mission again with two men? Should it be a man and a woman? How about two women? The final decision was made by a group of politicians that included Soviet Prime Minister Nikita Khrushchev. It was said that Khrushchev was looking for a Gagarin in a skirt. It was decided that a man and a woman would fly the two spacecraft. The male pilot would be Valery Fyodorovich Baikovsky. His mission in Vostok 5 would not only rendezvous with another Vostok spacecraft, as had been done just months before, but also set a new space duration record. The choice of the first woman in space wasn't as cut and dried. Everyone assumed the choice would be Ponomaryova, but mission planners worried that her moral values were not stable enough. That, and an almost debilitating landing during an earlier parachute jump, completely knocked her out of the running. The choice was made. It would be Tereshkova. Baikovsky's launch was plagued with delays. It was originally scheduled for June 7, 1963, but it was postponed due to high winds, which violated launch constraints. 2 days later, the Vostok rocket was erected on the pad, but the launch was postponed again due to an expected increase in solar flares. Even though the Vostok was protected from radiation, scientists had no clue as to what increased radiation would do to the craft or passenger. The launch was further delayed on June 14th. With only 1 hour before liftoff, engineers realized that the ejection seat was not cocked and loaded. This would have been a fatal error, since that was the only way the cosmonaut could land, shooting out of the capsule in his seat to parachute to the ground sans capsule. The capsule had to be reopened. Once the ejection seat was ready, the countdown continued until, at T-5 minutes, one of the gyroscopes on the rocket failed. However, engineers felt confident enough that they could launch Bykovsky safely and resumed the count. Finally, at 14:58 Moscow time, Vostok 5 was launched. Aboard Vostok 6, Tereshkova had a much easier time with a nearly flawless launch. With the code name Chaika, Seagull, Tereshkova took wing right on time, rocketing into the skies over the Baikonur launch complex on June 16th, shouting joyfully, "Hey, Sky, take off your hat, I'm on my way." The mission itself was a huge success, with Vostok 5 and Vostok 6 orbiting the Earth simultaneously, getting as close as 3 miles apart, which allowed them to communicate with one another. 30 minutes after communications were confirmed, Moscow began blaring the news to the world of yet another Soviet space first: a woman was in space. Everything was going well for Tereshkova, with only a few minor exceptions, such as a nagging pain in her right shin that became very disturbing by the third day, she recalled, her inability to complete biological experiments because she couldn't reach the equipment, and a dislike for the food. "The bread was too dry," she said in her post-flight debriefing. "I didn't eat it. I mainly ate the black bread and tubed onions. I threw up once, but it was due to the food and not due to vestibular problems." Later reports suggested a different story. She had lost her appetite, vomited more than once, was losing weight, and as ground controllers radioed the craft to discuss her upcoming landing, there was no response. Turning on the cabin's television camera, they found her asleep and flipped on the cabin lights to wake her. The cosmonaut continually told mission control that she was fine, but those on the ground believed that fatigue was setting in and began complaining that they were not getting clear responses from the world's first woman spacefarer. As reentry time neared, the Vostok's automatic reentry software began to fail, causing the spacecraft to begin a slight tumble, pushing the craft out of position for the required braking burn that would start her descent back to Earth. This would require Tereshkova to do a manual burn of thrusters to position the craft correctly. When she failed to make the burn on her first opportunity, Korolev became livid, taking it out on the Russian equivalent of the Americans' capsule communicators, shouting at them that they need to teach her how to operate the spacecraft. On Vostok 5, ground control radioed to Bykovsky that due to insufficient boost during launch, his orbit was decaying and he would have to make an early landing. Both Bykovsky and Tereshkova were then sent the command to begin braking and reentry. Bykovsky replied that he was ready. There was no reply from Tereshkova. Unbeknownst to mission control, due to the loss of radio contact with the cosmonaut, Tereshkova's craft had already made the burn and was beginning to deorbit, heading for a landing near the Kazakhstan-Mongolia border. Although Tereshkova's debriefing told a different story, many believed that she was partially unconscious after ejecting from the capsule and parachuting to the ground. Upon landing, she broke all protocols by not waiting for medical teams to arrive. With the aid of local villagers, who had arrived on the scene first, she stepped out of her flight suit and accepted offerings of food. In exchange, she handed out her remaining space rations. It would take almost 7 hours for mission control to receive word that Chaika had landed safely. When the news finally reached Korolev that the pilot was safe and that the mission had ended successfully, he remarked, "So now I'll have to agree one more time to launch abroad." Despite breaking the rules, Tereshkova became a national hero, winning the official title Hero of the Soviet Union and receiving the Soviet Union's Order of Lenin and the Gold Star for bravery and service. She also received the United Nations Gold Medal of Peace. Once again, the Soviet Union had chalked up another space first, and as news of her journey spread around the globe, Tereshkova became a worldwide hero, not only for her accomplishment, but also for opening a door for women. Author and former Congresswoman Claire Booth Luce wrote in an article for Life magazine that Tereshkova had orbited over the sex barrier. But just as quickly as that door opened, it slammed shut again. It would take the Soviet Union another 20 years to launch their second woman into space, Svetlana Savitskaya, aboard the Soyuz T-7 mission in 1982. 2 years later, she became the first woman to walk in space. It took the Americans much longer to launch their first woman into space. NASA's class of 1978 saw 35 astronauts selected to fly on the space shuttle. Of those, six were women: Shannon Lucid, Margaret Ray Seddon, Catherine Sullivan, Judith Resnick, Anna Fisher, and Sally Ride. Ride would be the first into space, aboard the space shuttle Challenger on mission STS-7 in 1983, when she used the robotic arm to launch the first shuttle pallet satellite, SPAS-01. Upon selection, Ride thanked actress Nichelle Nichols, who portrayed Lieutenant Uhura in the original episodes of the television show Star Trek, for recruiting her into NASA. Nichols had contracted with NASA in 1977 to create a recruitment film for the new breed of astronaut. "If it wasn't for you," Ride told the actress, "I might not be here." All the other women in the class would fly at least one mission. Judy Resnick was an electrical and biomedical engineer who flew on the maiden voyage of Discovery on STS-41D as a mission specialist. Before the flight, a Jewish magazine asked her to do an interview. She declined, telling her father, "I don't want to be a Jewish astronaut. I don't want to be a Jewish woman astronaut. I just want to be an astronaut, period." Her promising, pioneering career in space was tragically cut short on January 28, 1986, when the booster's launching Challenger exploded, killing the crew of STS-51L. Catherine Sullivan made history as the first American woman to walk in space in 1984, and in 2014, she was confirmed by the U.S. Senate as the 10th director of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. Sullivan made history once again in 2020, when she visited a place where no other woman had gone before, the deepest depth in any of Earth's oceans, the Challenger Deep. Sullivan was 68 years old when she boarded the submersible to make the 7-mile journey below the surface of the Pacific Ocean. One of the women who was later selected for the astronaut corps, Eileen Collins, paid homage to the Mercury 13 women when she invited the surviving members of the group to witness the launch of shuttle mission STS-63, on which Collins became the first woman to command and pilot a space shuttle. In written testimony to the U.S. Senate in 2012, Mae Jemison, the first African-American woman in space, neatly summed up the advances that women were making in space exploration. "Today, although women still represent a minority of the astronaut program, our space program is more inclusive. And as a nation, we accept women in space as a routine occurrence." Even though it took more than 20 years for the United States to send a woman into space, women were still filling important roles back on Earth for NASA. We have all heard the story of the African-American computers from the hit movie and best-selling book Hidden Figures. But there were other women who have also stood out through the years in NASA history. Up until the flight of Apollo 11 and mankind's first landing on the moon, women were not allowed into the firing room at the Kennedy Space Center. That all changed when Joanne Morgan was put in charge of the instrumentation console and communications and broadcast systems for Apollo 11. The title of first woman to serve as a NASA engineer went to Frances "Poppy" Northcutt. She was the only woman working at Mission Control during Apollo 8's historic first manned flight around the moon in 1968. She was also one of the engineers who helped MacGyver a solution that brought the Apollo 13 crew home from the moon after an oxygen tank exploded and crippled the spacecraft. Margaret Hamilton is credited with coining the term software engineering. As a NASA contractor on loan from MIT, Margaret helped develop the software for Apollo 11, winning the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2013. Despite a slow start, the history of women in space has been accelerating. The most exciting advancement for women in space came when NASA announced the 18 astronauts to train for the United States' return to the moon. Of the 18 trainees, 9 are women, and one of them will be the first woman to set foot on the lunar surface. The project is appropriately named Artemis, the goddess of the moon and the twin sister of the Greek god Apollo. The women selected include Stephanie Wilson, Jessica Watkins, Kate Rubens, Jasmine Mogbelli, Jessica Meyer, Anne McLean, Nicole A. Mann, Christina H. Koch, and Kayla Barron. In another first for women in space history, NASA has introduced its first female launch director, Charlie Blackwell Thompson, who will guide the launch of the largest rocket ever built, the Space Launch System, as it sends the women of Artemis to the moon. Before we leave these tales of women who are pioneering space travel, we need to return to the original Mercury 13. As I finished writing this book in the summer of 2021, an extraordinary tweet was sent by Amazon founder Jeff Bezos. As is the case with billionaire Sir Richard Branson and his Virgin Galactic project, Bezos wants spaceflight to be more accessible to the public and created a new commercial enterprise, Blue Origin, to do just that. The first flight of the company's New Shepard rocket, which was named for America's first astronaut, was set for the morning of July 20th from a desert launch site in West Texas. After 15 successful unmanned launches, New Shepard took 4 passengers on a 10-minute suborbital ride. The passengers included Bezos, his brother Mark, 18-year-old Oliver Damon of the Netherlands — the original third passenger gave up his seat after paying $28 million for the ride — and one more very special guest. In the video that was attached to the Bezos' tweet, he is seen talking with Mercury 13 trainee Wally Funk. You can see the 82-year-old's face light up as Bezos describes the flight. Later, after describing the flight plan, Bezos tells the veteran pilot, "That is your very first flight." Before Bezos can complete his sentence, Funk grabs the man and pulls him in for a long, hard bear hug. 60 years after being denied the chance to make history and live her dream, Wally Funk's long countdown was to finally reach liftoff. In 1961, Bezos wrote in the tweet, "Wally Funk was at the top of her class as part of the Mercury 13 Woman in Space program. Despite completing their training, the program was canceled, and none of the 13 flew. It's time. Welcome to the crew, Wally. We're excited to have you fly with us on July 20th as our honored guest." And so it was that on July 20th, 2021, at 9 a.m., Funk rocketed skyward from the desert to an altitude of 66 miles for a 10-minute suborbital flight. The veteran aviator was giddy as she tumbled weightless for 2 minutes with her crewmates. Not only was the flight a culmination of the dream of the Mercury 13, but it also put the aviator in the record books, the oldest person to fly in space, beating John Glenn's record by 5 years. The record was short-lived, however. Only 3 months later, Star Trek star William Shatner rode the same rocket into space at age 90. More important than the age record, Wally finally had earned her astronaut wings.